God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer. Joining me this week is Mr. Chapin Hemingway and Tyson Balcom. Thanks, guys, for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, so on this edition of the podcast, we're going to be looking at the new film in theaters, Dangerous Method, David Cronenberg's new film, starring Michael Fassbender. And we're also going to go into a discussion of David Cronenberg's career, kind of how it's evolved over the few decades. And we're going to wrap everything up with our top five doctor-patient relationships in films.
Sex.
Male.
Family.
Child.
Divorce.
No.
Professor Freud.
And Dr. Jung.
I've simply opened a door. It's for young men like yourself to walk through it.
Perhaps she's the one for your experimental treatment.
Tell me about the first time you can remember being beaten by your father.
It excited me!
And how is your little Russian patient?
There was the most dramatic improvement.
Is she a virgin?
Almost certainly.
If you ever want to take the initiative... I live in that building there.
So we all went out to see David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method. And the film, for having quite a intellectual topic, was pretty short at around 140 minutes. Sorry, around an hour and 40 minutes, excuse me. And I found this movie to have a fairly narrow focus. So my question to you guys is, did you feel that that narrow focus was encompassed enough to make for an interesting movie, or did you want to see more developed? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think I see what you're asking. You know, for me, I didn't have an issue with the focus of the movie. I thought it kind of had its mindset of, you know, we want to tell the story of Carl Jung, his relationship with his Russian patient, and his relationship with Sigmund Freud, who's, you know, obviously his father figure in the movie, and, you know, the father of modern psychoanalysis. So I didn't really have a problem with the focus of the movie. I can understand, you know... how, because there was obviously much more going on in the field at that time, how, you know, if you were watching the film, you could think that, you know, they didn't really do as much as they could in terms of telling a grander scope of the field. But I felt like they kind of knew what they wanted to do, and Cronenberg specifically really wanted to focus on Jung and focus on just telling this part of his life and how that helped lead to and shape him into becoming one of the foremost thinkers of psychoanalysis after the First World War. So I didn't really have a problem with the focus. Maybe Tyson, you felt a little differently though.
Yeah, you know, I think that it was pretty interesting that they chose, because a lot of this relationship that they chose to focus on is kind of speculation. I was saying to Chapin as we were watching it, as soon as I got home, I knew I was going to go and, you know, Wikipedia and research all of these characters, because they were all, you know, historical figures, just to see what they had, you know, where they had strayed and where they had focused on, you know, factual background information. And I just thought it was a little bit interesting that they focused on this relationship that no one is certain really took place. With all of the, you know, with all of the information that they did have, and a big part of what I noticed was that they, all of the correspondence that they have back and forth between Jung and Freud, that was just kind of this backdrop. They had the, you know, the voiceover narration for all this correspondence. They have, you know, people have, and they've used it to write books and all of these things. And in that sense, I do think it was narrow, because that's the dynamic I would have preferred to focus on. And I thought that the conflict that eventually, comes to pass between Freud and Jung, and the dynamic between the two of them, I would have liked to see more. And in an hour and 39 minutes, you probably saw them together on screen for about 10 of those minutes. And, in that sense, I thought that the best of the three performances in this movie, Viggo Mortensen, was kind of wasted. And I don't know, I thought that we didn't quite get to see that, because it was so focused on this one dynamic and relationship between Jung and Sabina Spielrein. So,
I understand, the disappointment, because I do think Viggo Mortensen gives an excellent performance as Freud in the film as well, and I can understand the disappointment that they're not on screen very much together. But but at the same time, I feel like that kind of reflected the fact that they lived in two separate areas of Europe. They weren't actually, they really didn't see each other too much. It was really just through that correspondence that they kind of shaped their relationship. And then the few times they did have together, we see how that affects their relationship as well. And you kind of see that relationship deteriorate as the film goes on a little bit, and they're differing minds, unable to accept the other person's ideas as it goes on, and I think it was just kind of more realistic to what the relationship was. I think it was a professional relationship that became friendly with the promise of, Freud's promise of Jung kind of leading the way in psychoanalysis for the next few decades, which eventually did happen. But because of his varying ideas, their relationship was just kind of tarnished because of it. So I feel like it would have been a little difficult to make, a film that really focused specifically on that relationship, because we have their correspondence, but, they were never really together very often. So I think it would have been tough to really kind of imbue more of that into the film, because even though they're not together much, they really do. A lot of the film really is about their relationship and discussing each other. Well, at least Jung discussing Freud, even when he's not near him, whether it's with his wife or whether it's with Sabina or whatever. So in a sense, the film really is about their relationship, even when they're not sharing time together. But at the same time, I feel like they needed more. And in that, Keira Knightley's character, Sabina, to really flesh out the entire film.
Yeah, it's difficult for me, because I think what I respect so much about this movie is its efficiency. But I did feel that the Freud character was underdeveloped, and this may be enticing. You said you really liked Viggo Mortensen, but this may be a criticism on his performance. But I felt his character wasn't fully realized, in the sense that I was always waiting for something more to come from him. He seemed to have a lot of a big problem with, or it was implied that he had a problem with, Jung's wealth, or the wealth through his wife, and there was some envy there or something going on, but that was really never developed. I was sort of waiting for more to happen, and I don't know, it never really materialized. But that being said, I think, I do think Cronenberg is just a very efficient filmmaker, and he doesn't leave much to
waste.
Right, exactly. There's not much waste, and so I felt that made sense here. And so I don't know, where do you draw the line? Where do you, I don't know. I'm trying to.
I think I see what you're saying. I mean, I can see where you're coming from, because it seems like, and it seems sort of like to me at times, that Sigmund Freud was kind of just, not necessarily a caricature, but just like everything that you would think when you think Freud, where he's always hammering, you know, everything revolves around, you know, basically in the movie, he's always hammering, you know, everything revolves around sex, and Jung's trying to get him to see another side of it that might not necessarily be it, but he's very steadfast in his reasoning of it. So I guess you can consider that kind of like a caricature of what you would think Freud would be, simply because, you know, that's what people think about, especially those who want to hammer Freud, you know, or put him down and just like, oh, well, you know, everything just revolved around sex and, you know, someone like that. I mean, is that kind of what you're thinking, or... I don't know, maybe I'm off or something.
Well, I think we got the information, like that's there's no doubt about that. Like we got I understand that dynamic. I just mean as a character, Freud wasn't developed as much. I feel like we didn't know him well enough. I got the idea between the strains between his beliefs in sex and psychoanalysis and the differing opinions about it, which is sort of what I mean by what I liked about the movie, is that it didn't go beyond those parameters. We saw how those ideas were developed in Jung's personal life, and but we didn't really nothing expanded beyond those general explorations of how these ideas developed, but I just didn't feel that the character of Freud was developed enough, and I didn't like Viggo's performance as much as I thought. I thought Michael Fassbender had a much more layered, deep character, but we spent, you know, four times as much screen time with him.
Yeah.
So I did leave the theater feeling like, well, I'm not really sure what Freud's role was here. I totally understood Carl Jung, but I don't know why we were meant to think about Freud.
See, and that's where I think that had they, you know, because Jung enters into this relationship with this patient that basically, you know, proves each of Freud's points that he makes during their meetings about how, you know, psychological trauma is often sexual in nature, I think it was that sort of masculine stubbornness and Jung's unwillingness to admit that maybe he had been wrong that prevented him from communicating all of these points to Freud after this had happened. And I think had they done that, it would have made for an interesting story, or more interesting story rather, because, you know, it would have validated this point and Viggo's character might have been a little bit more prominently involved in the goings on.
So then all in all, how did you guys feel about the movie?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I thought it was fine. I mean, I thought Keira Knightley's performance was a little bit much, in particular at the beginning. Even when she was supposed to have sort of like mellowed out and developed coping methods for how she felt about certain things, I still thought the performance was a little bit over the top. But I don't know. It certainly wasn't what I'd come to expect from a Cronenberg film. I thought it was pretty interesting that it took, you know, an hour and 15 minutes before there was any blood on the screen of any kind. And I don't know. It was a passable movie. I didn't dislike it, and I didn't leave the theater loving it. So it's one of those movies where I'm glad to have seen it, but it's not one that I feel I'll need to see again.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a good, not great film. I don't know if I would necessarily say it wasn't equal to the sum of its parts, because I do think that Viggo Mortensen and Michael Fassbender both give really good performances in it. Keira Knightley, I would agree, like, especially at the beginning, and from watching the trailers, I didn't think she was very good, but honestly, her performance really kind of grew on me towards the end, and I really didn't have as much of a problem with it by the end of the film as I did at the beginning. I think it's a solid, good film. I mean, honestly, you know, the only issue I really took with the film was kind of the pacing. I felt like it, you know, the first two thirds were really good, but then by the last third of the film, it had really slowed down and had really kind of lost the conflict within it. And so, you know, I kind of felt that the pacing could have been tightened up a little bit, and the climax and endowments was really mellow there at the end. So I feel like the last third of it kind of is a little all over. But otherwise, I think it's, you know, it's a solid movie. You know, it's a solid 8 out of 10. You know, I don't know. What do you think, Chapin?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was entertained from start to finish, and I think that has to do with the fact that he didn't try to do anything extraneous with the movie that wasn't involved in the main. Like, I enjoy the efficiency, and I think that kept me interested. I mean, there's a lot of material here, and he may, you know, we've talked about what he could have developed better, but for the most part, I think he was efficient enough that he kept my interest consistently. And I liked all the performances, and I thought they were interesting. And I didn't have a problem with Keira Knightley at all. I mean, I think that you have to kind of, you're always going to be bordering on overdoing it in performances, but or depictions. So, you know, I give her a little bit of a break, and yeah.
Gotcha. I liked it. All right. So we're all in general agreement. It's a good, decent movie. Good.
Yeah.
You know. All right. Cool. So, well, let's move on then to a discussion of Cronenberg's career. You know, I'd kind of maybe suggested this as a topic just because to me it seems, and I don't know how you guys feel about that, he just sort of feels almost like Cronenberg's mellowed out as he's gotten older. You know, he started with really crazy, you know, violent, strange movies with, you know, Scanners and Videodrome. And you know, he would move on to do Dead Ringers and Naked Lunch and Crash, just like really, some of them really strange. Like Crash was about people who were, you know, sexually aroused by car accidents and things of that nature. And so, you know, he's kind of always been known as being just a very weird and out there filmmaker. But what we've been seeing with his last few efforts, is just more conventional filmmaking. History of Violence, Eastern Promises, and A Dangerous Method are his last three films. And I mean, all of those are just straightforward, good storytelling. Eastern Promises and History of Violence are certainly violent. But you know, they still tell a very like straightforward, story. And I thought, I loved History of Violence and Eastern Promises. Eastern Promises, especially, I really loved. So I've really liked his last few efforts, and I guess even Spider to a degree was kind of more conventional, you know, storytelling from him. I mean, what do you guys think? Do you think he's kind of mellowed out, or maybe that's not the right word for it? Maybe he's just kind of gone to telling more straightforward stories. I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, I haven't seen a lot of his older movies that you've mentioned, so I'm only familiar with his more recent work, but. It seems that he has. It seems certainly his subject matter has.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think. But he does have that. God, I don't even know how to describe it really. But it's like a. It seems like kind of a. Like a sci-fi nerds or a sci-fi director's. Sort of lack of. Sentimentality. I think that might be the best way to put it. I mean, he's not afraid to show some pretty intense violence, and which, you know, obviously the past couple of films have studied. But yeah, you know, I don't know.
What do you think, Tyson?
Yeah, I haven't. Like Chapin, I haven't seen the only movie of his that I had seen prior to. The three that you listed, his three most recent was, I had seen parts of Dead Ringers. And, you know, just in doing a little bit of research for this podcast, it seems that it is pretty clear that, you know, he started out with this, there were, you know, his first movies were this, I think that I saw it referred to as like a body horror genre with movies like The Fly and Videodrome, and you know, his obviously his choice in both subject matter and storytelling style have changed pretty dramatically. But I think that, you know, he's found an area where his talent lies, and I, like you, I loved Eastern Promises. I saw it several times in theaters, and I own it now on Blu-ray. And I think that's the type of movie that he is really able to shine with. And I had gone into this hoping for something somewhat similar. Obviously, I knew that based on the subject matter of this movie that it was going to be a little bit different. But you know, I think that it's not necessarily a good or bad thing. He's just kind of shifting gears at a later stage in his career. And for the most part, he's been able to be pretty effective with that change.
Yep. So, yeah. So, Brantley, like, did he seem to have the same sort of storytelling methods in his older movies that he does now?
He really kind of pioneered that, like, horror, that body horror genre. But I mean, you know, all of them are good stories, and you know, he's definitely been a good storyteller throughout his career. But I mean, I was just kind of struck with, you know, his last few efforts, just because they've been so different from what his kind of traditional style of film has been in the past.
But do you mean different in the sense that they are, the subject matter is different, or are they?
Yeah.
Or is the storytelling different? Because you can kind of see Eastern Promises and History of Violence in A Dangerous Method, but they're very different stories. I mean, those are both very, very. Sorry, the first two are very violent and deal with violence. But this there's obviously no violence in A Dangerous Method.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt you could see his. See David Cronenberg in this movie. Is that what you mean, or has he changed his storytelling ways to sort of keep up with this new subject matter, more mature subject matter?
I mean, I'd say for the most part, it's really just a change in like content. I think for the most part, his storytelling methods and, you know, ability to tell a story have stayed the same. I think really it's just the subject matter for his movies. Hmm. You know, I hate to call it like, you know, more mature efforts or anything, because, you know, he's like freaking 68 or something already. So, right. You know, it's not like these, you know, the last few movies have only happened when he's been like an adult or anything. But I mean, for the most part, yeah, it's just like a basic storytelling, you know, just doing more basic subject matter. I mean, the only film I can really think of that he made, that I've seen at least, that was really kind of a strange storytelling was Naked Lunch, which is based on the William S. Burroughs, I think it was William S. Burroughs' book. And that's just kind of all over the place. That's just like a weird, you know, all over kind of movie in which the storytelling was different. But no, I mean, I really think it's just been subject matter and just focusing on telling more straightforward stories rather than, you know, just doing these crazy kind of horror films.
So, Brantley, can you make a reasonable defense for A History of Violence? Because that's a film I really don't like. But I really like Eastern Promises. So,
mm-hmm.
what's your defense in a couple minutes of A History of Violence? Why do you like it?
I like Eastern Promises because it's like a slow boil style.
No, sorry. A History of Violence is the one I don't.
Oh,
like.
Did yeah. I say Eastern Promises?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I meant History of Violence. I don't know why I would have said Eastern Promises. No, I like A History of Violence just because I think it's like a slow boil type of thriller that just slowly escalates into, you know, the finale at the end. I think Cronenberg does an excellent job of just kind of pacing it like that and keeping the tension within the film so that it constantly grows and you're just, you know, worried about what's going to happen next. Are they going to, you know, come and get his family at the house, or is he, you know, what's going to happen there towards the end? So that's why I really like A History of Violence.
Hmm.
I don't know. Maybe Tyson has.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's
better defense.
That's a great way to put it. You said like it's kind of a slow burn, and there's this, you know, you're introduced to this family, and you see this dynamic that you then watch change, and that I think that really lends itself to it. I think that. Most of the, you know, when I think about History of Violence, I think about a lot of different other people's commentary that I've heard on it or jokes that I've heard about it in movies, because it's got this like really sort of visceral sexual content that, you know, is hard to divorce yourself from thinking about right away when you think about the movie. But, you know, beyond that, I think it tells a pretty unique story that, you know, I think made for a great movie. And, you get to know this character. I think his name's Tom. I have this movie. I haven't seen it in forever. And, you know, you've watched this dynamic change, in particular the one between him and his wife, that I think is really, really cool, because, you know, this is this woman who, you know, it would be such a weird position to be in, where you think you know somebody so well, and then this thing happens, and you're kind of, you know, for me, like Brantley said, you're kind of on edge the whole time. You know, wondering what's going to happen and wondering whether his wife is really just going to lose it on him beyond how badly she does. And you're just waiting for everything about his character to change. Like, if he goes too far back down this road, he's not going to be able to come back. And when after he finally kills off Ed Harris's character, and then he, you know, leaves to go to Pittsburgh to meet John Hurt's character, you know, at least for me, you're kind of, you know, in that position, you're kind of worried that if he goes down this road, like I said, he might not be able to come back. And, you know, that's this really slow buildup that, you know, has just the right amount of, you know, intensity or violence or action, you know, randomly inserted into certain points to keep you interested until that it all culminates in that showdown at William Hurt's mansion. And then the conclusion is great, with the family sitting around the table and everybody just kind of accepting that they're going to be able to deal with it. You know, I don't know. I just thought it was really good. It's really kind of underrated, because I think most people probably liked Eastern Promises so much more. That movie kind of goes a little less noticed than.
See, I think it's the other way around.
Really?
Yeah, I think people like the other one better. Okay, let me ask you guys this. So the visceral violence in both those movies, History of Violence and Eastern Promises, we can understand why it's there. But what's with the sex in A History of Violence? Like, you're right, Tyson, and that's a good point. That movie is, it's exactly as you described it, very visceral, very...
Yeah.
I don't know, almost, it's almost, it's very, I don't know, I don't know how to explain it. It's very... What am I trying to say? Yeah,
visceral. It's like a little unsettling. And the weird thing
is, uncensored. It's
you know,
kind of
as late 20s males, we've probably all seen in some form or another much more aggressive or intense sexual content on screen somewhere. And yet, you're sitting here watching this scene between a husband and wife that's you know, equal parts romantic and kind of kinky and whatever, where she puts on that cheerleader outfit. And I remember seeing it with a girl that I was dating at the time and just kind of like squirming in my theater seat, sort of uncomfortably watching this. And it's, you know, it's much more tame and emotional than plenty of stuff that I've seen before. And it's really weird. It's, I think it's because it might feel a little excessive or unnecessary at that point. I mean, maybe it demonstrates a healthy and sort of still rich dynamic between a husband and wife and the love or the fire that's still there in their relationship, which is important, because then you can juxtapose that with this like huge crash that they go through and this sort of washout what sort I'm looking for? This kind of backlash of this event that happens at the diner and all of these people from his old life coming back, but it is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that makes those such visceral scenes, too, in the movies, I don't think Cronenberg really gives you anywhere to go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the film, but I know the scene I'm thinking of is specifically on the stairs. I don't know if it's – I don't think it stays in a long shot or like a wider shot the whole time, but he like shows you the whole – act. He doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't think he doesn't cut away from it like a lot of times when you know couples start to and you can see what's going to happen and they cut away because it's like, oh, we don't need to show you this.
Yeah.
Like he keeps you there, so you have to watch. And you know, and it's not like, you know, it's not terrible, you know, scenes of, you know, sex depicted that we've seen before, but I think it's because he doesn't give us that release from it. Like he just makes us kind of, you know, watch the whole event on screen, that's what makes it so much more visceral and uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a really good point, really. And, you know, I couldn't have put it better. The, you know, a similar method was used in the most recent Dragon Tattoo movie in that, you know, awful rape scene because the filmmakers, they really want you to have to endure or experience this situation because I think it helps give you perspective or a more vested interest in the components of the story, so that's a good point. And I think the same is true of that big fight scene in the bathhouse in Eastern Promises. And mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people say, like, "Well, why did Viggo have to be naked in that?" And well,
that makes
you know,
sense.
Yeah, and I think that's you know, it just ups the stakes and it adds this like degree of intensity to it all. And you know, the same might have been true of the excessive spanking scenes in A Dangerous Method. You know, we had several of them and I was thinking about that and, you know, you could have sort of somewhat tamed them up and, you know, Keira Knightley was topless in one of them and, you know, I think that it's, like Brantley said, he wants to kind of put you in this position where you have no alternative. I mean, sort of, you know, covering your ears and closing your eyes, you're in it and a part of it and, you know, I think it makes it a little bit more intense.
Right. So, yeah, that makes sense. I think, but do either of you guys think it was excessive in either of those, in History of Violence, the sex?
Some of it.
Go ahead, Dyson.
There's a scene where Maria Bella walks out of the bathroom and she's in a bathrobe and she's not wearing anything underneath it and it's just open and you see her, you know, and it's full frontal nudity and then she just sees her husband, gives him this look of disgust and then walks back out of the room. And in that sense, I think some of that stuff is a little bit gratuitous. You know, I understand. I mean, we've had conversations before, Chavin, about this, about the violence. And I think, and you know, while I don't think any of the violence in those movies is very over the top, I think it all serves a purpose and it's motivated. I mean, maybe it shows a vulnerability in her character or maybe a lack of vulnerability. Maybe it shows a strength that she can kind of stand there and be defiant and still cop this attitude with him, even though she's, you know, she's in her most vulnerable state there. And maybe that's the purpose. I think that might have been construed as a little excessive, but certainly not the lovemaking scenes or the aggressive sexual scenes. I think that those were all, you know, not only justified, but earned and, you know, motivated and helped to further this relationship throughout the story.
Yeah. And I actually wanted to add a point on the violence of A History of Violence. I think one thing that really makes those scenes of violence, because they seem as so violent, is I think just the juxtaposition that they have with the setting. I mean, they're out in, you know, the country. It's a rural area.
Small
there's
town,
this
middle America.
Yeah, there's just stillness, and you don't expect, you know, vicious acts of violence to happen within those areas. And so when the scenes of violence do happen, I feel like it really, you know, it's not necessarily like a shock, but it kind of comes on as kind of like it has a shocking effect to you based on the surroundings of the film. So I feel like that kind of helped to enhance the violence in the film and make it seem as violent as it was.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hey, Will. I don't know a lot. You see this? Holy shit. It's not your fault. Yeah, I know that.
Look at me, son. It's not your fault.
I know.
It's not your fault.
I know.
No, no, you don't. It's not your fault.
I know.
It's not your fault.
All right.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Don't fuck with me. It's not your fault.
Don't fuck with me, all right? Don't fuck with me, Sean. Not you.
It's not your fault.
Okay, so today for our top five, we're going to be looking at doctor-patient relationships in honor of the doctors in A Dangerous Method. Why don't we start with you, Tyson, and any criteria you had?
Okay. Well, first off, I'd like to say that this is my Soprano Melfi memorial list. and the criteria I had was that it had to be a direct patient of the doctor. It couldn't be, you know, as much as there are obviously several great relationships, and I tried to keep these ones I'm about to mention in my honorable mentions, but there are great relationships between movie characters where one of them is a doctor and the other one is just a friend or somebody that they're put up, you know, that they develop a relationship with, but I wanted it to be a direct patient of the doctor, and that was my only real criteria. So, having said that, my number five is, and I don't have the actors' names for some of these also, just so you guys know, I have the character names. My number five is Dr. Stephen Maturin and William Blakeney in Master and Commander of the Far Side of the World.
Damn.
Which is and for people who might not have seen it, Blakeney, or might not remember the character name, Blakeney is the young boy who loses his arm because he gets an infection from shrapnel. From a cannonball blast, and they develop this great relationship kind of outside of a doctor-patient relationship based on an equal love of this naturalist side of Paul Bettany's character. And, you know, when they're in the Galapagos Islands, they venture out and do some exploring, and, you know, there's just a very evident admiration from Blakeney's character to the doctor, and it's the dynamic is really great. So
cool. So my top five, my criteria, it wasn't as strict as yours seemed to be, Tyson. Obviously, you know, it had to be a doctor, but it didn't necessarily have to be a medical doctor. I felt that the way I kind of figured it was, they didn't have to be like a specific patient, like the doctor necessarily worked on them, but like if the doctor was using his medical license kind of on the character,
yeah,
then it was, I deemed them like patient, even if they weren't a specific patient, like, you know, paying them money or whatever.
Yeah.
So that might seem strange, but it'll become more apparent as my list. When you hear things on my list.
Now that you phrase it that way, I think we'll have one of the same ones for sure because of okay. The way that you just worded that. But
okay. So, well, my number five is the Elephant Man, and that's Dr. Frederick Treves and John Merrick. Played by Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt.
Great. Just took too long.
Sorry, Chapin.
That's the drawback of going last, which is why, like, you know, it's always fun to intro the top fives and you get to go last, and the off chance you get the best ones, but if you go first, sometimes it screws you.
I didn't mean to go last. My list is bad. Okay. I'm trying to work around that. My number five is Dr. Richard Kimball and himself is the
pick. Oh, that's a good pick.
That's a really, that's good. I was trying to think about how to make that work, but I couldn't. I wasn't smart enough, so well done.
I totally spaced on The Fugitive. Good call.
Nice.
Very good.
That's my only good pick. I should have left that for number one.
Yeah, that's really good. That's funny because I hadn't really thought about that when he patches himself up. Yeah. I think that's funny when he goes in and he steals the guy's egg salad sandwich and he's like stuffing the little chunks in his mouth.
That's right.
Nice. Okay. My number four is Dr. Peter Silberman and Sarah Connor in T2 Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good one. Pick.
Yeah, it's the dynamic is what's great about it. I mean, they obviously don't have a very healthy working relationship, but when she sees him for the first time, well, when we're first reintroduced to her and she goes, "Morning, Dr. Silberman, how's the knee?" And, you know, she's got the syringe in his neck with the, like, drain cleaner and stuff. It's great. It's really funny. So that's my number four. Yeah.
That's a great scene. And that's a good pick. I wish I had thought of it because that's really good.
Well, my next three are all very predictable, so much less enjoyable.
Okay. All right. Well, my number four is Dr. Sam Loomis and Mike Myers from Halloween.
Good one.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good one.
Thank you.
All right. As the obvious pick of all time, mine is Dr. Hannibal Lecter and what's her name?
Clarice Starling
from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the one when Brantley said that about using their doctor prowess. That's one of my honorable mentions because she wasn't a direct patient, but that's obviously a great one.
Yeah, that's going to show up later. And that's the one I was specifically talking
about. Yeah, that's what I thought because of how you said it.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. My number three is Dr. Madeline Madden and Billy Costigan in The Departed.
Oh,
dynamic. Yeah. It's you know, there's nothing quite like seeing two attractive people with plenty of sexual tension culminating that, you know, with Vera Farmiga in her underwear. So that one, that's my number three.
Good, good pick there. Let's see. My number three is Lionel Logue in King George VI The King's Speech.
That's a good one.
Thank you. I thought the film was a little overrated, but in terms of doctor-patient relationships, I mean, that's all about the relationship.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, mine is... hold on a second. Let me look this up real quick. Idi Amin and whatever his personal physician in the Last King of Scotland.
Idi Amin and the Last King of Scotland. Yeah. And nice.
Yep. James McAvoy. I think he's like an amalgam of a couple different real life people.
But... Yeah.
Dr. Nicholas Garrigan.
Yeah, there I still go. Haven't seen that movie, which is weird considering how much I like those two actors.
Yep.
All right. My number two, these are going to get real predictable. My number two is Nurse Mildred Ratchet and R.P. McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I just thought you would leave that out.
After Chapin and I left this movie, I said this is going to be my honorable Ratchet McMurphy list. But then I thought about The Soprano Melfi, which is, in my opinion, the greatest of doctor-patient relationships. So. And obviously this is another one where it's just that, like, that, you know, disgust and rancor and all this. It's the Silberman-Connor dynamic again, which is really enjoyable.
So. Yeah, that was an honorable mention of mine. So I did not have that one on my list. I guess I think I kind of put it off because I guess I wasn't thinking the nurse as a doctor. But if I look at my next pick... I'm not even sure if the person I list as the doctor is even a doctor in this next movie. He might just be a regular psychologist and not a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But it's Sean Maguire and Will Hunting from God the Good Will Hunting. Sorry. Sorry.
Well, like I said, mine were, you know, you deserve that pick anyway, so that's good. All right.
So that was my number two, Chapin.
All right, mine is just a moment here. Let me get the full name here. And just to give you guys a hint, the patients are all of us.
Okay.
And I am thinking of Alfred Kinsey from Kinsey.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's a good one. I haven't seen all of that movie either.
Good pick.
All right, my number one, Brantley, Dr. Sean Maguire and Will Hunting and Good Will Hunting. So obviously, that's like I said, you know, that's just a great one. Doesn't need much explanation.
Nope, no, it doesn't. And my number one also has already been said. It was Dr. Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling from Silence of the Lambs.
Damn. Nice.
Oh, you gotta close it out good now, Chapin.
Yeah. All right.
You gotta have like an epic pick here for number one.
I do.
Okay, what you got?
It's also Dr. Stephen Maturin, but the patient isn't Lord Blakeney. It's the midshipman dude who has the thing put in his head.
Oh, yeah. Is them his brains, Doctor?
Right. Is them his brains?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
I can't even find that guy's.
I don't know what his name is. The Hold Fast guy.
Basically, he does the first metal plate.
Yeah.
He uses a little
spoon. Yeah. It's awesome. Nice. Very good. Okay, well, I had some honorable mentions that I liked. Obviously, the Hannibal Lecter one was one of mine, and then some more fun ones. I had Dr. Bill Hartford and Victor Ziegler, or Tom Cruise and Sidney Pollack in Eyes Wide Shut. I thought that relationship was really great when he comes to kind of bail him out after he's been sleeping with that girl, and he's like totally unashamed as he's putting his clothes back on, and there's this girl that's passed out naked in this room. And then the really fun one that I would have worked into, it probably would have been my number one had it worked a little bit better for my criteria, was Emmett, Doc Brown, and Marty McFly in Back to the Future.
That would have been an awesome pick. Yeah, so, that's a good one.
Yep, that's a good Doc relationship. And he's always going, "You're the Doc."
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to thank everybody for listening, and I encourage you to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. You can see all of our articles, reviews, videos, all of our podcasts are there as well. And there's a donate tab. If you want to help us keep doing what you're doing, we would greatly appreciate it. But thanks for listening, everybody.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.